All right. So, you know those things that you put up to your eye and like look through? What are they called?
Kaleidoscopes.
Right. Okay. That's my description of Jeanette Winterson's body of work. Kind of like a diamond, also multifaceted. Jeanette calls herself a working class kid, and she was raised in the oral tradition. I think her parents had something like 6 books in the house. 3 of those were Bibles. She left home at 16 and studied at Oxford, and at 24 wrote her first novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, which won a Whitbread Award. From that point on, Winterson's work has ripped through time and space and our assumptions about living. She writes for children. She writes for television. She wrote a story for Oxfam. She wrote a comic book. Her journalism has been featured in The Guardian and the London Times. Her stories have been performed by the Royal National Theater. She's written something like 20 books. and she's renovating a house from the 1780s, okay, in her free time, okay? So she's multifaceted not only in her form but also her content. She writes about desire, religious questioning, power, identity, art. Much of her work addresses the concept of time. And I like to call these texts not science fiction but forward fiction. Of Winterson's latest work, The Battle of the Sun, the Sunday Telegraph says, an exceptional book, big, ambitious, and awash with Winterson's usual inventiveness. Now, you can really only get that, I think, in the UK. So if you go to amazon.co.uk, you can find it there. Some of the books that she writes are only available in the UK. No? No? Okay. Oh, they're all here? Okay, great. So then forget that. I'm very, very pleased to introduce Jeanette Winterson.
Oh, can't really be 20 books, can it? That's such a worry. It is 25 years this year since Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit was published, which seems to me to be a colossal amount of time. I don't know what happened to the 25 years in between, apart from other books and other work. But as most of you here are pretty young, what I can say to you is that it gets better as you get older, which is great. You have to worry about less stuff, and you just think, it's fine, you know, I can do this. And then you get to the cusp point about now, and you can sort of see the end, and you can look back. And in fact, that's rather comforting. It's not frightening at all. So don't put up with any shit about how getting older is a real problem. You all have to achieve everything by the time you're 29. It's just not true. The whole thing just goes forward with you in some strange way, which isn't quite progress, but is a journey worth making. I am going to read to you a couple of things tonight, because we discussed this, AM and I, and we decided instead of doing 2 blocks, you know, the way people normally do, we would do smaller pieces so that we could break the evening up a little bit. And you'll have to excuse me, because I'm a bit jet-lagged, because there was no flights to New York yesterday, so I came in today, and it's been a lot of travelling, and a lot of snow, and a lot of life, but I'm here. So that's good. And I'm going to read to you a bit from The Stone Gods, which you can get in the States. It was a novel I published a couple of years ago. Battle of the Sun is for kids, by the way, but, you know, we're all kids. But The Stone Gods is set, it's 4 parts, and it's set in on a planet which doesn't really yet exist, though it's called Planet Blue. And it's a new home. It's a place that we get to. It's a place that we find when our own home is dying. So that's the kind of science-forward stuff that happens. But this is in part 2, where the narrator finds a text on the underground and gets jolted back into a beginning of her own. It's very short. I was travelling home on the subway tonight, and I noticed that someone had left a pile of paper on the seat opposite. It was late, I was a bit drunk, and a bit tired, and just a bit fed up with everything. So I swung across the centre gap from one bum-soiled seat to another, and carefully shifted the bundle onto my knees. It was yellow, maybe pre-war, I don't know, you don't see much paper anymore these days. Maybe scrap, maybe rubbish, maybe an instruction manual translated into English from the Japanese. The Stone Gods, said the title. Okay, so it must be anthropology, some thesis, some PhD. What's that place with the stone statues? Yeah, Easter Island. I flick through it. There's no point starting at the beginning. Nobody ever does. Reading at random is better. Maybe hit the sex scene straight away. At night, in the belly of the ship, I lay beside Spike and thought how strange it was to lie beside a living thing that did not breathe. Okay, a love story, that's what it is. Maybe about aliens. Yeah, I hate science fiction. There's a name and address on the front page. I wonder if there'll be a reward, or is that just for cats and dogs? I had another look. What's this? Everything is imprinted forever with what it once was. Is that true? This is the story of my life. Before I was born, curled up like a universe waiting to happen, my mother heard that my father was not going to marry her. It was too late to do anything about me. I was coming, ready or not. And whatever I was there. She was going to give birth. My grandmother believed in trial by baby. Take the thing in your arms and go from door to door until someone says, yes. They had no television, no phone, no car. They hadn't been long off rationing. It was the war. The streets where they lived were a junkyard of bomb damage and scrap. I was born on a metal frame bed, horsehair mattress, spring coils. So much blood that they had to burn the sheet. But I was born, and nothing anyone can do about that. My advice to anyone is get born. So here I come, turning like a skydiver, head first, my skull soft and open where the stars come in, and one star just visible like the bud of a horn. Here I am, using the edge of the star like a laser to cut through the soft tissue of the uterus, a light-edged baby into a star-cut world. The bed broke. The springs in the middle had to be held together with fencing wire. It snapped. My mother folded in half and I pulled out like a calf from under her. Don't cut the cord. Get some fencing wire and tie me to her. The line that fed me, the line that breathed me, the line that tapped messages from the world outside, the line that was a tightrope between her fear and my joy. The line I would have to cross someday and never come back. The line that is the first line of this story. I was born. The line that had nothing to read between it, being only one only, my lifeline. Cut it. My grandmother cut the cord with her teeth. Her teeth were false, and the greasy, bloody umbilical cord caught in her top plate and pulled the teeth out. She went to soak them in Steridant and left my mother to her first milking. Joy! I wanted to be born. I wanted to be here. Fear. She didn't know what to do next. She was young, 17. My grandmother was not yet 40, but it was a different world then, because the world is always remaking itself. And after the war, there was a lot of remaking to be done. And I was born in the ashes of the fire. And that's how I learned how to burn. I remember reading that Samuel Beckett remembered life in the womb. Everybody believes him because he won the Nobel Prize. I doubt that anyone will believe me. And if they do, they won't understand that it's possible to be telling the truth, even in the moment of invention. I remember my mother telling my grandmother that she wanted to make a new life. They'd been going to Ireland on a boat, her and my dad, and now he was going and she wasn't. And she said she couldn't sit at home and look after me. I was knocking on her stomach wall and trying to be heard. Don't stay at home. We can go together. I don't eat much. She didn't hear me. She was frying bacon in a burnt pan on the gas stove. I was pressed against the slot where the grill pan goes. There's not much room in there unless you are a grill pan. And I can see why no one wants to spend their life in front of an oven. So we did mopping and washing. She was tired. We went to sleep under the quilt. And it was the last night that I would ever spend inside her. Keep me in the mop bucket or the slot where the grill pan goes, but don't let me go because I love you. Love without thought, love without conditions, love without promises, love without threats, love without fear, love without limits, love without end. I think she did love me for a minute, for a second, for the time it takes to remember, for the time it takes to forget. We had 28 days together, and then I was gone.
That was really great. A.M. Holmes' writing is like a fist in the face. And the tongue of my mind is still worrying that tooth she knocked loose when I first read her work. If you can imagine. Her work is like one of those Chinese finger puzzles, you know what I'm talking about? You're trapped, and the more you need to escape it, the more it grips you. You're just like, but you're like, you have to stay with it because it's like so incredible. Her work has been translated in 18 languages. Her most controversial book, The End of Alice, which is narrated by a jailed pedophile, was banned in parts of the UK, so you know it's doing the work of literature. According to the New York Times, in Holmes' stories, strangeness becomes a revealing back entrance into the human condition of our day. Amy Hempel says Holmes is sharp, funny, playful. Holmes finds shocking entry points and then makes them spin. For example, the opening scene in her book, Music for Torching, features a couple burning down their house. These stories make for excellent visuals, too. So Hollywood has come to Holmes. She was a writer, producer of the hit television show The L Word in 2004-2005, and wrote an adaptation of her first novel, Jack, for Showtime. Zadie Smith says of Holmes, "To my generation of writers, Holmes is a kind of hero, and the mistress's daughter is the latest example of her fearlessness and brilliance. It's a compelling, devastating, and furiously good book, written with an honesty that a few of us would risk." May I introduce Aim Holmes.
Thanks. It's kind of, it almost looks like a mirror tonight. It's like, hello. It's always a treat to be at NYU because I have a very deep and long connection with the school, and Fred and Tom and Deborah and everybody. Thank you very, very much. And it's a super treat to read with Jeanette because we have done in various contexts, in various countries, different things, but weirdly enough, we only discussed upstairs what, in fact, we were going to read tonight, and I think that this piece, you'll see, has an interesting echo to what you just read. I've been doing for the last couple of years a lot of collaborations with visual artists. It's something I really like, and I've been fascinated by talking to artists about their creative process, and one of the things I've done is I used to write art criticism. Now that's so... Don't get me started, no. And one of the things I realized, though, was often the piece that I would write for a magazine like Art Forum was, over time, the only documentation you would find about a show. And then I decided at a certain point I wanted to try to write fiction that both reflected to some degree the artist's intention and ideas, but also went on from that. So I would spend a lot of time talking to an artist about how they made what they made and why they made it and what it meant to them, and then try to craft a piece of fiction that reflected what I learned, but also something else. So this is a piece that I wrote for the English artist Sarah Jones about her photographs. And the two little things I'll tell you about it are, this was a series of photographs. She showed some of them here at Anton Kern in New York. Some of them are of psychoanalysts' couches here in New York and also of English common roses in England. And it's called Whose Story Is It and Why Is It Always on Her Mind? She is seeing the doctor now. It was a condition of her release. The thorns, he asks. Yes, she says. plucked from rose stems, she drove the thorns deep into her skin, pressing them like shark's teeth in a line up and down her arms. She pressed the thorns into her skin until the skin gave way and buried the thorn, and then she took off her shoes and pushed the thorns into her feet and walked from park to park, carefully collecting more thorns. Specimens, she called them. Her wounds became infected. The infection spread into her blood. "We almost lost you," her mother said. "I was right here the whole time, hiding in plain sight." "I see you're walking with a limp," the doctor says. "I am treading lightly." "Why thorns?" "It runs in the family." She glances over her shoulder to see if the doctor is listening and catches him off guard. Their eyes meet, and she looks away. "Continue," the doctor says. She lies back, her fingers stroke the deep blue fabric on the doctor's couch. My mother rearranges the furniture constantly. She is trying to make something that she remembers, but I'm never sure if it ever really happened. She says she is getting closer. She is no longer young, but she gathers the energy to push the sofa around the room, and when she's done, she cries. It will never be the same again. It is always almost there, but not quite. She can't put her finger on it. The light, the silence. Every day she tries a new combination, hoping the pieces will fall into place like the pin tumblers of a lock, hoping there will be an opening and something will be revealed or recovered. "What are you going to do with that?" I ask as she moves a lamp from this table to that. "I am going back to where I come from," she says. "But it does not exist," I say. She makes still lives, tableaus of how she wishes it were. "Is it the same sofa, the one from before?" she asks me, now confused. "That's what you've always told me. I don't know anymore," she says. "Maybe it came after the fact." She calls the war the fact. My mother's sofa is also blue. "Finished for today," she gets up carefully. The next time she visits the doctor, she notices a hair. She sees it as she's approaching the doctor's couch, a blonde hair like a golden thread glinting in the light. She doesn't know what to do. Pick it up, stretch it between her fingers, and pluck it like a harp string. She imagines winding it round and round a finger until the finger turns blue and pressing it against her neck like a fine gold wire. What to do? She pretends not to see it. She lies down on it, the blonde hair beneath her own brown hair, the blonde hair becoming from a time a part of her, but she can't bear it. Whose hair is it? Does the doctor have sex on this sofa? My mother was born the day before the war ended. She was a girl without a father, a miracle. For a long time, she believed that. We all did. The fact is, during the war, my grandmother was left at a Catholic boarding school. Her parents brought her there in the middle of the night, turned their backs, and left. As she screamed for them, the nuns held their hands over her mouth. The way the story goes, he appeared in the garden behind the school. She pretended not to know what happened, but it is possible she really didn't know. It was a war. She was terrified they would die. The only thing that kept her sane was that the roses kept blooming. That's where they found her. Entangled in the rose bush, pinned by the spindly arms of the prickly vines, he came into the garden, bent to smell the roses, and saw her. He pushed her into the roses. When he was gone, she remained trapped. She lay in the garden all night. She watched the sky go dark, the stars come out. She looked up into the blue, the internal, the unending, the unnameable. She was asleep when they found her. Grandmother woke up, but only partially. It was as if she was under a spell, in a fog. Sometimes she would come out from under, but mostly she seemed baffled, like it all just didn't make sense. As a child, my mother knew that her mother hated her, but she didn't know why or what she'd done wrong. My mother kept herself hiding, in boxes or under the table, inside closets. She would pretend she was invisible. Later, she would hide in the woods, behind trees, or in a pile of leaves. She would play chameleon and practice shifting her skin to match the environment. When other children came to play, my mother would hide, and only after they left would she rush to the window, press her face to the glass, and look at them leaving. My mother found out when she was about 13. She doesn't remember how, but she said it explained a lot. When she found out, she went on a nighttime rampage through all the parks of London and cut the roses. She brought back hundreds of roses. She filled my grandmother's house with roses from bud to bloom to past their prime, cabbage rose, common rose, tea rose, each with delicate petals like human flesh, each with a perfume, a beautiful scent turned putrid. The theft of the roses was a crime. The roses belonged to the city, to the people, and they were not for the benefit of just one. The story of the theft made all the papers. Her mother was horrified and threatened to turn her over to the authorities. "I can't have this," she said. "It's too much. You're doing it to me again. You're just like your father." You are the proof that you can't escape your history. And together they cut the roses and their long thorny stems into little tiny pieces and boiled them down. She pauses. Does anyone have a life of their own? She asks the doctor. He doesn't answer. Her third visit is different. There's something on the sofa, like a doily or a napkin covering the little pillow. Is the hair still beneath it? Is it being hidden, kept safe? She lies back and says nothing. She looks at the room, the light through the windows, a lamp, part of a painting, an extra chair, and a table with a plant. She's thinking of her mother moving furniture, of her grandmother trapped in the roses. She stares at the plant, a beautiful white and purple orchid, and wonders, did the doctor buy it or receive that as a gift? Is it real, she asks. Does it look real? The doctor answers. When the session is over, she sits up. The room spins, a kaleidoscope blurring. She falls back onto the sofa. But your time is up for today, the doctor says. She cannot get up. The doctor seems flummoxed. This has not happened before. He goes to his desk, rummages through a drawer, and finds a tin of hard candy. He offers her one. It is red and in the shape of a rose. She sucks. The sugar, the sucre works wonderful. Wonders. She dreams she is walking on water, and it is raining rose petals.
Yeah, I'm going back.
Okay.
Okay, hang on. Look, this is a good idea. You don't think so? Then I think you get. Do they get to ask questions afterwards?
Good idea.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. That's a good, great idea.
Okay, you might have to shout. Okay, this is a story about a dog. And I'm everything in this story. I'm the narrator. I'm the narrator's friend, and I am the dog. Just in case you thought that things weren't autobiographical. Who said that? But the print's not very large. Okay. There are some days when the sun is so bright that when you look away, everything turns black. I had a dog like that, a sun-black dog, with the light in him so bright that the rest of life went into shadow when he was killed. Now you know the end of the story, but not the beginning. And the end of a story is, well, only the end. And much happens on the way there, like people who set out at dawn and sleep at nightfall, and the sun makes his journey with them. So I will tell you how I came to find the sun running beside me, and how that brief and lit-up time has changed the way I think about things. Not just the big things, but the small things too, because, you will notice, the sun lights up everything, old socks, discarded magazines, dust, cobwebs, as well as the handsome house and the beautiful view. And the sun will dazzle off a piece of broken glass as easily as off a church window at midday. The sun is a democrat. Rich and poor alike stand in his rays. Dogs are democrats too, and don't discriminate between Gucci and worn out. That is not to say that they have no discrimination. They do. But dogs are on the side of love. They love life and they love you. And they will valiantly do their best to love life, however inadequate that life may be. And they will valiantly do their best to love you, however inadequate you may be. Dogs are love on four legs. Yes, they say, I will. And yes, and yes. I discovered that life could be yes instead of no. And I discovered that life could be love and not its lack. That's a big thing. Along with it, I discovered that an old shoe is better than a diamond bracelet, and that a ball is the round world in little. When I threw him his blue ball, he chased it as though it were the globe itself he was chasing through the wide heavens, eager to land the one place where life could be found. He brought it back to me, delicate between his jaws, and dropped it at my feet, the world in little. Trust. Happiness. Throw it again and again and again. Make the world new every day. And to him it was new every day. The sun rising on a planet still damp from its making. The clean early air of a fresh start. I had need of a fresh start. What I mean to say is that sometimes something quite unexpected enters your life, something you did not plan for, were not even, if at all, thinking about. I never wanted a dog. Dog was not on my wish list or even my tick list. I didn't notice dogs in the street the way that boys notice cars or men notice blondes. I like animals, but my life was not dog-shaped. My girlfriend wanted a dog, and I said yes, because that was easier than a baby. The dog was a kind of Jungle Book baby. No schools or night feeds, nothing that couldn't be managed with a ball and a lead. Simple, easy. Yes, yes, I said, I will, and yes. So the dog came home. Home. Home is so familiar that it needs no looking at, no explanation. Come through the door and home's just there. The pictures, the books, the kitchen table, the leaky tap, the sitting room painted not quite the right shade. And if there are things to do, well, they don't have to be done now. Sit down, have a drink, eat some supper, put the washing in the basket. The dog took the washing out of the basket and ran with it like he'd found the meaning of life. Give those trousers to me. No. Give them to me. Come on, good dog. No. Holy law of the jaw. Don't let go. He was called Maximilian on his pedigree, a king of Bohemia or some far-flung shore where miracles happen. I could have changed his name to Rex or Sam, but he walked like a Max. Part swagger, part comedy turn, and something of where the wild things are. It was the wild thing in myself that he tamed. It was my job to train the dog. He took it upon himself to tame me. I have never settled. I've never said yes to someone without reservation. I'm not sure that I've said yes to life without reservation, as if by reserving something to myself, I would not be mangled, tangled, strangled by the demands of this world and the demands of others. It's not wise to give unreservedly. I am a generous person, kind, seeing, would withhold nothing except what must be withheld. There are gifts and they're gladly given, but the self is a gift with reservation. Absurd to love a dog so much that there was no reservation. But I did. When he was a puppy, he went everywhere in a cotton bag. We took him to the cinema one night and he slept on my knee all the way through the film, and I pretended not to notice that my legs were getting wetter and wetter as his bladder emptied while he slept. We took him to a photographic exhibition, still in his bag, and while we walked from photo to photo, he stayed quite still, warm and soft through the bag like a living secret. But whenever we stopped to admire something in particular, his curious black head popped out and looked sleepily at the photograph and sleepily at us, as if to say, you walk, I'll dream. And that's how it was when he was small, falling over his own feet, tiring, needing to be carried, us walking, walking, him dreaming, dreaming. A black, curled-up ball of dreaming. A dream dog. And then later, bigger, stronger, he did all the walking, me panting to keep up, never could walk him to exhaustion, his long, strong body sleeking through the air like a thought that comes back and back, like a boomerang flung out of sight but coming back and back. Out we went, long walks, long days, and then I was the one doing the dreaming, the rhythm of him releasing my mind. A dream we will always be together, a dream we will always be here. I dream we are in a wood, a dark wood. And midway through it, midway through life, I dream I am travelling. The branches are dark with their own shadows. The crows are flying home. Night is falling. Black air, thick with crow's wings. My black dog. It's late. Dream me home. I woke up to the telephone. It's the dead of night. Where are you? Do you believe that love is as strong as death? Not stronger, as strong as the hostile twins fighting it out through the stretch of the universe. Who wins? Death takes the easy victory every time, but love never steps out of the ring. You want to fight? Fight this. You live in my life, not in my memory, not in thoughts, in my life, the cellular me, the renewing DNA. I am a part of all I've met. You are what I met. A part? Yes, we are. Death can do that. Separate? No. Love holds you here. While I am alive, so are you. And we go on together, because we can't be any other way. And to think it's you, just up ahead, waiting for me. Always just up ahead now, waiting for me. I'll be there. You ran faster than I could follow. I used to send him to stay with a friend in the country. She had a terrible time of it, because he didn't understand that a hen is best left unmurdered. She walked him long and hard, and he built sinew and muscle, and he muddied her kitchen floor, and when she took his bed away from the cooker, he dragged it back and lay looking at her with his big eyes. He knew where he wanted to be. It was the summer, and every night she played him the BBC proms on the radio and cooked her supper with the back door open, and he ran in and out, and her cats sat on the corrugated roof of the shed, their fur in ripples like the waves of the roof. And on rainy July, August nights, she lit a tinker's fire with fallen wood, and the dog and the cat sat in front of it, like different stars in the same sky. Animal dark, animal fire. She said, he startled three deer and chased them, amazed by their easy grace and light and speed, and he tried to bound as they bounded, one, two, three, leap, one, two, three, leap, but they cleared the hedge and vanished like mist, and he was left on his hind legs, puzzled, barking. What kind of an animal vanishes? She said, we crossed a fox, burning red, early, alone in the field, dew heavy up to his belly in thick grass. Max gave chase, and the fox turned at bay and threw all his red power at the black young dog. I wish you'd been there to see him, spine contracted, head down, blurring his paws to get away. And up the hill he came towards me and stood panting, tongue out, looking back at whatever it was that had reddened him into flight. What kind of an animal is red? She showed him the world, the green world, the blue world, the white world, the river world, where he sprung in, flung in, chasing ducks and scrambling out as joyful as every river drop shook from him, racing the narrow, muddy path, happy, happy. What kind of an animal is happy? This one, this one, this one, this one, this one. I'm curled up now, narrow muzzle on my forepaws, drying off, fed, watching you. The whole world, look what we've got. The whole world. Yes is chaos. No is control. Every yes I ever said brought with it a downpour, an avalanche, a heaven's opening chaos, and doused me in life, water of life, swept off my feet. Better swim for it, deep breath. He loved water. He was a spaniel. I loved the splendid chaos of him, my fearless dog. In chase, in repose, spinning universe of nose and paws. Call him and he'll come, call him. He ate poison twice and it didn't kill him. He raced across an open road and a white van took him down. We waited all night, waiting, waiting. He was so strong, but this time he didn't come back. I called and I called, but he didn't come back. Love is not one thing, one kind. Love is not one shape, one name. Love is chaos, because it is bigger than any of the boxes it comes in. And as soon as you get it home, it fills the whole house. He was so tiny the day we brought him home, and he grew. And so did love. He stole my shoes, my cardigans, my pens, my gardening gloves, my string, my car keys, my heart. And in return, he gave me the sun running, running. Running, running, running. Thank you.
That is just such a beautiful story. I'm screwed. Does anyone have a phone? Because I'd like to just call Sarah Palin really quick and just see. Maybe she could help me now. So can you ask for a lifeline? Hi, Sarah. I have questions. Taxes. Future. That really is just amazing. It's so funny. Mine's about a cat. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so... I wish. I wish. Okay. So this is that's just really, you know, it's how can I follow that?
My name's Am Holmes.
This is a story. It's another collaboration I did, and this one was with another English artist for Rachel Whiteread. And if you know Rachel's work at all, hopefully it'll make some measure of sense. Do you need, we could let her out now. Run! I'm just kidding. Okay. This is called... there's always this, you know, we were joking before, there's a moment where you could just devolve into stand-up comedy, and it's happened before, is all I'll say, and I won't say any more. Okay. This is being recorded for the radio, so I'll try to stay on track. Oh, yeah. It's good you know that now. Okay. The weather outside is sunny and bright. In the morning, there are marks where the pillow touched his face, where his T-shirt wrinkled against his back, from the waistband of his underwear, elastic indentations, ghostly traces. He peels off the socks he wore to sleep. The pattern is like a picket fence. With her fingernail, she writes on his chest, milk, butter, eggs, sugar. The invisible ink of her finger rises up like a welt. In the shower, it becomes perfectly clear. Dermatographism. For the moment, he's a walking grocery list. It will fade within the hour. I dreamt I was in the 18th century having a tea in a very elaborate cup. He is a clockmaker lost in time, keeping track of the seconds, fascinated by the beats, hours passing, future becoming fast. And you? How did you sleep? I dreamt the building was sealed. There were no doors, no windows, no way in or out. Nothing to knock, nothing to ring, nothing to bang against. The house of glass was suddenly all solid walls. You are what you dream, he says. It's true. She puts on her shoes, slipping a small piece of lead into both left and right to keep her mind from wandering, to keep herself steady. I'm late, she says. You have a feather. He reaches out to pluck something poking out of her skin. She sometimes gets feathers. They erupt as pimples, and then a hard quill like a splinter presses through the same way a feather sticks to the ticking of a pillow or the seat of a sofa. Is that the only one, she asks. He searches her arms and legs and pulls out a couple more. All plucked and ready to go, he says. Thanks, she says, and don't forget the groceries. He nods. Yesterday there was a fox in the woods, and for a minute I thought it was you. I went to say hello, and it gave me an angry eye. You're not angry with me, are you? It wasn't me, he says. I was at the office all day. Actually, she says, sorry. On her way out the door, she puts a clump of dirt in her mouth and presses a pumpkin seed in and swallows for good luck. Drive carefully, he says. He sprinkles fish food into the pond of koi, flips a penny in, and waves goodbye. Outside, the lawns are being watered. The garden men are going around with their weed whackers, trimming and pruning. There's the tisk-tisk hissing of sprinklers as they spit water over the grass. Winding down the hill, the landscape reminds her of Japan, of Scotland, of another country in another time. There's fog in the canyons, the hint of blue sky at the top of the hill. The weather changes from block to block. It's impossible to know what kind of day it will be. She sits at her desk, poring over drawings, reading between the lines. Her workspace is industrial, minimal, a skylight, an exposed wooden ceiling, furniture from an old factory. 4 pens on her desk, 10 paper clips, a plastic spoon, 20 steps from her desk to the door. She is always counting. There's something reassuring about numbers. She does math in her head, math to keep herself entertained, to keep everything in order. Magnetized, she attracts things. Right now she has a paper clip on the tip of every finger, like press-on nails, and when she's bored, she decorates herself with loose change, quarters all up and down her arms. Her watch clings to her wrist, synced to her heartbeat, her pulse, and even 60 beats per minute. When she exercises, she takes the watch off, afraid of breaking time. You are a magnetic, highly influential person, a psychic once told her. People and things are drawn to you. Making herself a cup of tea, she puts in a pinch of catnip. It makes her pleasant and playful. When she smiles, a thin line of soil is at her gum line, is easily mistaken for a tobacco stain. Architectural forensics is her field. Why buildings do what they do. Often called upon as an expert witness, she's known as X-ray specs for her ability to read the inanimate, to intuit what transformed it, to find the otherwise invisible marks of what happened and why. A click of the shutter. Her day is spent looking, taking notes with her camera, making permanent what she sees in her mind's eye. She's a special kind of anthropologist studying what can't be touched or seen. She drives, moving through air, counting the molecules. As a child, she fell down a well, like something out of a nursery rhyme. Well, that explains it, her teachers used to say, but it didn't. One thing had nothing to do with the next, except that she was curious, always curious, but there was more to it than that. She walks with a slight limp, an unnecessary reminder. She remembers the well. She remembers she thinking she saw something there. She was 8, almost 9, leaning over, catching a glimpse of something in the corner of her eye. She remembers screaming as she fell, the echo of her voice swelling the well, wedged, her leg oddly bent. She remembers silence. And she remembers her mother shouting down to her, "Imagine you were a bird, a winged thing, and push yourself up. Imagine you are a flower growing. Imagine you are something that can scale a stony wall." Her mother shouting, many, many hours of firemen and ropes. She remembers thinking she would fall to the center of the earth. She remembers the blackness and her picture in all the papers. After that, while she was resting in bed, her broken leg healing, her mother would hold her hand and stroke it. What does it feel like to be a kitten? What does a kitten hear or see? And slowly her features would change and she would be a little kitten-headed girl. And what does a kitten do with her paws, her mother would ask, stroking her hand, and little furry mitts would appear. You're very special, her mother would say. When you fell down the well, you didn't know that. She nods, still not sure what her mother is getting at. Aren't all children special? Some children are born with a fine coating of hair, but when you were born, you had feathers. That's how I knew. When you were living inside me, you were a duck splashing. You know what a good swimmer you are. You had a lot of practice. People bring her samples of materials, combinations of things. They want to know what goes with that. What combination brings success, power? What juxtaposition spell trouble? What do you think of titanium, curved surfaces? How much does a building really need to breathe? They want to know what she knows and how she knows what she knows. Did you study feng shui? In the afternoon, she visits her mother. The doors of the nursing home open automatically and a cool disinfectant smell pours out, vacuum sealed, frozen in time. There's an easel by the main desk. Good afternoon. The year is 2010. Today is Wednesday, May 16th. The weather outside is sunny and bright. Her mother's unit is behind a locked door. There's a sign on the wall. Look as you are leaving. Make sure no one follows you. Her mother doesn't know her anymore. It happened over the course of a year. The first time she pretended it was a mistake. Of course you know me, she said. And her mother seemed to catch herself, but then it happened again. It happened more. And then sometimes she knew her and sometimes she didn't. And then she didn't. Every day she visits, she brings her camera, she takes a picture. It is her way of dealing with the devastation, the rug pulled out from under. Hello, she says, walking into the room. Hello, her mother repeats, a parrot echoing. How are you today? How are you today? I'm good. She sits at the edge of her mother's bed, unfastening her mother's long braids and brushing her hair. Remind me, her mother says, who are you? I'm your daughter. What makes you so sure? Because I remember you, she says. From before? Her mother asks. She nods. My sock is itching, her mother says, rubbing the tag around her ankle. All of the residents are tagged. An alarm goes off if they wander out. The tag leg is alternated, but it remains an irritant. What can we do, the nurse says. We don't want to lose anyone now, do we? She rubs lotion onto her mother's leg, and she puts a chestnut in her mother's pocket, just as she once saw her mother do to her grandmother to ward off backaches. She puts an orange she picked this morning on the nightstand, resting on a bed of clover. Protection, luck, vision. She takes her mother for a walk in the wandering garden, an inconspicuous circle. You always end where you begin. It guarantees no one gets lost. She visits her mother, and then she visits the other women up and down the hall. Imagine us, they say, sitting here like lame ducks. We see it all. There but for the grace go I. You look familiar, one of them says. I know you from somewhere. You know me from here, she says. The sea. She drives to the ocean and parks. She takes a picture. She finds the fact that she is not the only one moving, calming. She's a navigator, a shifter. She's flown as a gull over the ocean. She's dived deep as a whale. She spent an afternoon as a jellyfish floating, as an evergreen with the breeze tickling her skin. She spent 2 days as water and found it difficult to recover. She's in constant motion, trying to figure out what comes next. It is early evening. The sky is charcoal, powdery black. Everything is a little fuzzy around the edges and sharp and clear in the center. She's a coyote at the edge of the grass, her spine elongated, her nose pushing forward and her skull rolling back. There's something slippery about the coyote, a million years of motion of shifting to accommodate. She's coated in a viscous, watery solution. She digs through the bushes. There's a girl in the backyard floating alone on a raft in water. She walks to the pool, dips her tongue into the water, and sips. She hears the girl's mother and father in the house shouting, "What am I to you?" the mother says. "It's the same thing, always the same thing. Blah, blah, blah," the father says. "Your life is like a movie," the coyote tells the girl. "It's not entirely real." "Tell me about it," the girl says. The coyote starts to change again, to shift. Her skin goes dark, it goes tan, deep like honey, and then crisper brown, like it is burning, and darker still towards black. Downy feathers begin to appear, and then longer feathers, quills. Her feet turn orange, fold in, and web. A duck, a big black duck, a crow, a Labrador, but a duck. The duck jumps into the pool and paddles towards the girl. They float in silence. And suddenly the duck lifts her head as if alerted. She pumps her wings and rises from the water. She is heavy, too heavy to be a duck. Her body is changing again. Trading feathers for fur, a black mask appears around her eyes. Her bill becomes a snout, and she's standing on the flagstone by the pool, a raccoon with orange webbed feet. She waddles off into the night. There is a tremor. The lights in the house flicker, the alarm goes off, and in the pool the water shifts, and a small tidal wave sweeps from one end to the other, splashing onto the concrete. She hurries back to the car, shifting back to herself, and rushes towards home. There's a report of the tremor on the radio. "A little rock and roll action for you folks this afternoon. Freeways are stop and go. Crews are checking for damage." She takes the surface roads, afraid of the highways, the overpasses. She pulls into the driveway. The house is still standing. Nothing seems terribly wrong. Her key doesn't work. The small rumble must have caused a shifting of the tumblers, a loosening of the lock. The key goes in but won't turn. She's knocking. She's ringing the bell, going to the back to the car and tooting the horn. "I couldn't get in," she says when Ben opens the door. "The lock is broken," he says, turning the knob. "Your hair is wet. I stopped for a swim. I think you lost your shoes." He points at her bare feet. They're almost back to normal, but the middle three toes remain for the moment webbed and orange. "I rushed back. Are you all right?" she asks him. "Fine, I'm fine. The front window has a crack," he says. "Stress fracture," she says. "Did they call?" He nods. "About 15 minutes ago. I reported vibration and minor damage." In their backyard, there's a global positioning monument, a long probe sunk deep into the earth. Every 30 seconds, five satellites from around the world register the position of the monument, measuring motion in scientific millimeters. There are hundreds of them up and down the state. She and Ben get a tax credit for friendly use of the land, and every time there's an event, the phone rings. "Just checking in." When she stands near the monument and focuses on it, she can feel the satellite connecting, a gentle pull for a fraction of a second, a tugging at the marrow. "There are footprints," Ben says, pointing to the press of a paw on the loamy ground behind the house. "I'm thinking a dog or a deer." "Mountain lion," she says, bending to sniff the print, pressing her hand into the dirt over it. Ben takes a dry towel and rubs her hair. At the roots, her hair is fluorescent orange. The rest is brunette. The color changes according to her mood, or more accurately, her emotional temperature. The only way she can disguise her feelings or not look like a clown is to dye her long locks. "Are you especially frightened?" he asks. "The tremor threw me," she says. "Do I need a dye job?" He nods. "You're bright orange." She's cleaning her comb and brush, saving the strands, spinning and weaving a technicolor carpet. "Did you go out today?" she asks him. She notices all the grocery bags on the counter from i.com, the online food store. You type in your list and the groceries arrive within an hour. "The pollen was high, the air was bad. I stayed inside working," he said. "I made you a wonderful puzzle." Ben is perfecting a kind of time-sensitive material, a puzzle that shifts so the image changes as you're piecing it together. Every day he downloads photographs and turns them into something new. This time it's a picture of the sky at twilight, a single cloud. As they put the pieces together, the blue deepens. It becomes an image of the night sky. And as more of the pieces fit, a small plane flies across the sky, silently moving from piece to piece. In every room there's a clock. Ben likes listening to the tick-tock tripping of the hands as he travels from room to room. He runs her a warm bath and sits by the edge while she soaks. Ever since the fall in the well, she can't bear to be in water alone. "Benjamin, are you still thinking you can stop time?" she asks as he washes her back. "I'm working on it," he says. "How well do you know me?" "Very well," he says, kissing her. Her skin is the skin of youth, of constant rejuvenation, delicate, opalescent, like mother of pearl. "Is there a beginning or end?" she asks. "No beginning or end in sight, infinity." Out of the bath, he wraps her in a towel. He presses his mouth to her skin, telling her stories. Her heart races. The watch on her arm ticks faster. She begins to shift, to change. First she's the coyote, then a zebra, then a mare and a man. Her bones are liquid and pouring. She's laughing and crying in 10 different languages, barking and baying. His hands slide over her skin, her coat, her fur, her scales, her flippers and fins. He is sucking on the toes of a gorilla, kissing the ear of a seal. She is thick and thin, liquid and solid. They are moving through time, lying on pelts in a cave, and a hand-carved bed in a palace, nomads crossing the desert, calico pioneers in a log cabin. They are on a ship in a high-rise on the ice in an igloo. Their cells are assembling and dissembling. They are flying through history. She is a cloud, vapor, and texture. She is rain and sky, and she is always and inescapably herself. "Is that still you?" he asks. "I never know if you're really in there." "It's me," she says, sliding back into herself. "In the end, it's always me." So we're happy to answer some questions.
Yeah.
Especially from anyone way in the back. Maybe someone in New Jersey, if anyone has a question. They are. That's not even a reflection. It goes miles back there.
Yeah.
It goes all the way to 9th Street. Does anyone have a question? Perfect.
I wanted to know from both of you, actually, what you've had to give up in order to commit to writing.
Oh, no.
Everything. The honest answer, I have a little kid, so basically all I do... The question is, what did you have to give up to commit yourself to writing? And my answer is everything. To be honest, it's incredibly hard work and it's really tiring. And I have a little kid. And basically, at this point in my life, all I do is work and do the kid stuff. I don't have a life anymore. And it's fine. I'm happy. I really, really like writing. I really, really like being in my head. And I resent everything else. I resent any time the phone rings. I'm the only person who goes, "Who is that? That's not right." It could be anyone, but my mother. I love being in my thoughts and I love creating things. And then when I'm not, if I'm too tired to write, then I'm just lying there reading something else.
I'm not sure. I find that an interesting way of phrasing it, because whatever it is you want to do, you know that you have to close off something else in order to do it, because we do live in an infinite universe, but we can't inhabit that place. So we have to make choices which are often linear and restricted, or appear to be, rather than everything. And I think, the sort of have everything, do everything, be everything advertising culture has been very damaging. That you don't somehow you can have it all, and it will all fall into place, and that'll be fine. But it's really not so. And I think there's a nice Buddhist phrase which is that you can have the first thing in your life, but not the second thing, and not the third thing. And there is truth in that. If the first thing in your life is a really big thing, then you're going to have to fit everything else into that, around that. There's no option. That's how it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the rest has to follow, because you make that decision. So that's why it can never be a career or a profession. It always has to be a vocation. And if there was anything else you could possibly do, I would advise you to do it.
It's true.
Oh, yeah.
And the planet in the first story. Is there a connection there, and do you ever make those kind of connections between stories?
Is there a connection between Max's ball and the planet? I think, not just because they're round, but I think you tend to work with certain images that always bother you and return in different ways, just as you work with ideas that bother you and return in different ways. You just stalk things from every angle, I think. And I find that there is, for me, both in dreams and in work, a recurring set of images that I can't stop playing with. Which doesn't become repetitive, but it become, because they open, and that's what I meant about getting older, that the thing doesn't, anything that is symbolic and numinous in that way will go on opening the longer that you work with it, which is quite interesting, rather than closing down on you. You keep pushing the stuff, can't you? So those connections are always there. And what's weird now, and I said earlier about looking back over 25 years, is that books have to come in format, so that, they've got a cover on at the beginning and the end, so that's meant to be finished. But I no longer feel that. I feel as though the whole thing has been a continuous process, which occasionally has been cut off mm-hmm. in order to go out into the world, because you can't have this endless stream of consciousness running on there. And that, but really, that's not how it feels to me, and I can't always remember which thing is in which book or which place.
I think that's totally true, actually. That they come out as books as like slices of bread. At a certain point, they just had to like break off a piece. But you're sort of still in the middle of whatever that process was or whatever that exploration is. And I think you do explore the same things again and again. And then occasionally you retire something because you're kind of done with it and something else comes up. But then 5 years later, there it is
comes
again.
Back.
It all comes back.
Mm. You know. What does it mean?
Doesn't mean anything.
But I think it's very satisfying to work with those products of your own mind, and also very freeing, because you're never quite sure where it's going to take you. And I think in some sense it's purposeless, because you don't know where it's, you can't direct it. I think that's one of the great things about writing, about art in general. It cannot be corralled into the system as it is. You know, you can't ship it to Korea and get it done cheaper. No. You can't order the colour, you can't put it on deadline. You can try, but you can't, not for the real work. And it's almost as though the thing selects its own occasions. You can't even will it to behave, even after years and years of working with it. It just won't behave, will it? Whatever it is. So there's that place of having to work with something which you know and you're confident with, but is not in control. You're not in control of it in the way that we usually think of as control.
Nor would you really want to, because then it's also, then it's like, it's sad and sort of tiresome. And in fact, it's always those moments when you think you have it sort of all too sort of pinned down. And in fact, for me, it's those things where you try to really crack the thing open again, because you realize you kind of got a little bit lazy in it or something.
And you can't ever be sure that you'll write anything again anyway, can you? I mean, you do. You have the facility, but that's quite separate from knowing that you will write something which engages you or that can take you further. You could always repeat yourself. As soon as you've written anything that's halfway decent, you can repeat it in a way which is redundant, which isn't about pattern making, but which is about closing the thing down. Lots of writers do. They make a lot more money than we do. But it's not essentially formulaic, and it can't be, but it is pattern making. Sure. You can't ask her. Why do you think she can't?
She paid $2.
No, oh, did she? Okay.
Oh, she gave it to, did she not give you any money?
No. Well, in Britain, we don't even let you have one.
Well, there's not like a, you know.
You know, I heard a guy on a quiz show. I was in the gym. I was mesmerised by television. This has been on my mind, so I'll tell it to you. And the question was, Gloria Steinem, the 70s feminist, once said, this is the quiz master, a woman without a man is like a fish without her. And the guy said, bowl. The answer is bicycle. I've been bothering him. I thought, what on earth is in his head? So women are like goldfish, and he's not in the sea or anything, they're in a bowl. So that means, anyway. You couldn't make it up, could you? A woman without a man is like a fish without a bowl.
Anyone in the back have a question? Are you guys awake? Are you, no oxygen back there? Anyone in the back have a question?
Hello.
You can shout it.
Flight 74 is boarding now. Up here. No, sorry. Well, then we'll have another. Do you have another question?
Thanks. I'm just curious if there are any times where you get in the way of your own work, and if so, what do you do about that?
Shoot myself. Again and again. Yeah, I think, you know what it is? I think for me, I think I do sometimes get in the way of it. And sometimes it is a certain kind of fear. And you have to think about, what is it that you're afraid of? What is it in the content? What is it in the approach? What is it that's stopping you? I mean, I think it can happen, but it's also, you know, I think at this point in my life, I also am aware of, I feel like I don't have a lot of time. I don't have nearly enough time to work. I don't have nearly enough time to do anything. So part of it for me is, if I'm even a little bit in the way of what I'm doing, I do something else because I have so many other things I have to do, that also, it clears itself usually pretty quickly. But absolutely. I think it's a lot of fear. I think you have to look at what, and sort of be honest with yourself about what is stopping you. And usually if you ask yourself a couple of questions, I don't know, for me the answer just, it's like a billboard, you know. And I used to do this exercise where you had sort of, this is from a meditation book I bought when I was like 15 years old. Back when I was fascinated with Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. But I remember that one of the exercises was to imagine essentially a body of water coming out from, I guess about here, at least that's where I imagined it. And whenever something's bothering me, I ask myself, what is it? And literally, whatever that is, it's like I can see like huge mountains, and they just have like titles on them, like your mother, or the audit, you know what I mean? But whatever, and it's interesting too. It's a very realistic picture. Whatever the size or the degree to which the thing is bothering me, it is all in scale. So I get like a whole report card that way.
So how'd you get rid of it? I wasn't meant to ask.
No, I mean, I think about whatever it is, and I sort of think, what am I going to do about that, or why is that bothering me, or what is that thing? And some of it you can't get rid of. You have to just live with mountains.
I think turning up for work every day is pretty important. Or would it be? You know, people often say to me, "Well, how can I write?" And I think, "Well, write." You know, somewhere it's really basic, and turning up for work means that you often don't do anything, and especially in a world where you can churn out journalism or all that stuff, which is it's so easy to do, and you get paid lots of money for it, and then it's in print. So it's a real temptation to just think, why am I sitting here producing nothing or rubbish when I could be earning money, and you know, people respect me and all the rest of it? But I'm just here. So there's a lot about having faith with the process and not letting insecurities or anxieties about the world come into that space, or what the world wants or what the world needs or your position in the world or any of that stuff, because it's irrelevant. But I think being able to be in a space and not do anything which actually is any good or have to throw it away and be prepared to do that is very important, to know that you can spend a lot of time with something that won't work out in the way that you intended, right, and not panic about it. Because, you know, it's not work for hire. It's not so this whole tricky nature of it, that it won't always come when called. It won't work to order, which isn't to say you can just sort of arse around and just do fuck all and think, I'm an artist. You can't. I mean, you know, the turning up for work is really important, but also beginning to recognise what you need to produce the stuff. I mean, for me, if it's a big piece of work, I have to heat myself up to story temperature. And until I get to a certain level of heat, I can't really get on with the work in the way that I want. Once I get to that place, I can chuck anything in there and it will consume itself into a thing which is then all of a piece. You know, you can throw the old tyres, the mattress, the tin cans on it, but if the thing's just smoking, you know, you'll just burn yourself out of the room. It's no good. So I know when that happens now, but it's knowing these things in yourself and listening to yourself, becoming very close to who you are in order to make the work happen. And just having faith that it will, and not being scared to throw things away. You know, if it's bad when you've written it, won't get better in the drawer. So I would just chuck it.
Do you have to be by yourself to work?
Yeah. I mean, if I do for the big stuff, yeah, not for journalism things.
Right.
No.
Right.
Yeah, I have a little place with nothing. Also, I can't have the internet or the mobile or any of that, because then that's the world, isn't it? I just have a little room and a stove to burn everything.
I see a hand way in the back. Write it down and pass it. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I think we better.
That's a really good question. I'm going to repeat it. So, and I'll do it in another language. I'm just kidding. The question was sort of aimed towards Jeanette, and it was about the translation process and how much say do you have over how your work is translated and who translated it, and noting that also in certain languages, some of Jeanette's work, the sex or the gender of the narrator is not specified, and in some languages they are dependent upon that specification. So curiosity about that.
I had a good translator, and she just kept switching it, which was quite good. She kept just switching the pronoun and the gender of the narrator when it was in French. That was great. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of them. I can't. Some of them open backwards. And that is a real problem, because I think I don't even know which way it is, never mind what it says. So there's a limit, isn't there? I mean, you can sort of crib your way through maybe two or three and think, that's more or less what I said. But after that, you don't. And sometimes things come back to me that have been, you know, retranslated. I mean, scrambled back. And with my name on it, and I think, oh, no. Please God, I didn't say that. So there is nothing you can do, and you could spend your life killing yourself over it, but it's better not to.
Kate, what about you?
Both of you known for being risky out there, etc., etc. And A.M., you just talked about self-censorship.
Yeah.
Have you ever been censored in another language or in English? Has an editor ever said, don't do this? Has a script producer ever said, don't do this? Has a festival ever said, don't do this? Or have you been able to be more or less culturally free?
I have been censored. The question was about censorship. Yeah, I mean, it was about censorship. Have you ever been censored in any number of ways? And I say I've been censored a lot, actually. My first novel, Jack, which I wrote when I was 19 years old, is one of the 100 most banned books in this country. And it is like the sweetest book in the whole world. It's about a little boy whose dad is gay and his parents are divorced. And it's like, it's one of the 100 most banned books, and it's on the American Library Association's best books for the teenage. So I've been censored in those ways, and actually it is banned in certain school districts because they say that it advocates bestiality, because there's a line where the kid, Jack, is trying to explain that his dad is gay, and he says, you know, he sleeps with Bob, his roommate, and the other little boy, Max, says, well, I sleep with my dog, which is not supposed to mean right, but in just outside of Seattle, that apparently means a very different thing. So yes, I mean, and that's actually a very, literally a very wholesome book. And then other works of mine, like The End of Alice, which actually was banned in England, and the publication of which was canceled in France and in Belgium and Switzerland. And I think that that's a more interesting and potentially dangerous example, because that's a book that is told from the point of view of a jailed pedophile murderer. But the question about censorship also became, in this country, many publishers wanted to buy the book and were told by the heads of the publishing companies they weren't allowed to. And I think there is that sense of what, you know, is literature dangerous and what will it do to people? I'm not quite sure. My sense is that literature does not murder people and, you know, usually does not incite murder. But there even seemed to be some sense that by reading that book, it would cause people who didn't know better, which was one of the things in England because of the class system, people who were not educated wouldn't know not to do those things. So I've had a lot of it and really across the board. And I've also had it in other, you know, more subtle ways where it's just made clear to you that certain things are not a good idea. And it's interesting, I think, one of the things is that it's not always the things that are the most extreme or that you think will be the problem. In this country, The End of Alice, I was really worried. It was an election year, and I thought, I'm going to get in so much trouble. And there wasn't a peep here. And that, you know, in other places, it got picked up and made a big issue out of for other reasons. But are you censored?
I think I'm still banned in Texas.
That was something. That was.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Are you banned? The whole state?
Recently. Yeah, the whole state. I don't think I can enter the state of Texas myself. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, there was a lot of trouble, you know, this massive 25 years ago, because it was a different world, certainly with gay stuff. You know, we have moved a long way, haven't we? Which is fantastic. And a huge shift is taking place. I just hope we don't lose it the other way. I think the sort of censorship that worries me now is more that. Because we're entering, a stage of deep illiteracy and a fear of the imagination, then, in fact, publishers are just... There's a covert censorship about what can and can't be published.
Yeah.
That, you know, literary fiction now is much more difficult than it ever was. You know, they want the numbers up there. Booksellers themselves now sit on editorial boards and say, you know, this will sell in our shop, that won't. There's a lot of scary stuff going on in the background about what you actually see out there. It's very manipulative. And I'm quite scared of that, because we won't know. If there's a battle, and the thing's banned and it's about content, or you know, then you can deal with it. But if there's a, if there's an unspoken situation where people are saying, no, actually this won't, so we won't have it, we'll just have a kind of homogenized literature, like we've got homogenized movies, homogenized TV, then we're in trouble. Because, you know, we used to think that if we control the presses we'd be free, all those fights that went on. Now it's about distribution. The bookshops have enormous power. They sell their space. What you see in the front window is paid for. It's not just there because the nice bookseller likes it. The thing has become utterly political and manipulated, entirely motivated by commercial things. And for the first time ever, I've heard really good writers in England tell me that their publishers have cancelled their contracts. They're not taking the money back. They're just saying, we can't publish it. We're in a, it's a down market, and we won't sell this book anymore.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's interesting also, you know, in this country, even in terms of a sort of invisible shift, is the other day I went to see this movie called The Most Dangerous Man in America. It's about Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And one of the things that they were talking about, for people who don't remember, Daniel Ellsberg, it's a long story, but it's a great movie. But the short version is Daniel Ellsberg had copied these documents known as the Pentagon Papers that were really about the United States' involvement in Vietnam. And he gave copies of those documents to very powerful senators and different people in Washington who didn't do anything with the information. And ultimately, he gave the documents to the New York Times. And the New York Times sat on them for quite a while. And part of what prompted their decision was the realization that if they didn't do something with it, it would become known that they were the paper that didn't do something with them. And that's part of what they finally admitted to when they published them. But interestingly, they published the Pentagon Papers, a piece of it. And the Nixon White House got an injunction, stopped them. They then gave the documents to the Washington Post, who published a piece of it. They got an injunction, stopped them. It went to Los Angeles, went all around this country to all the different newspapers. What scares me is that that easily could not happen now, because the newspapers are very different in the post-9/11 world. And they pointed out that one of the things, one of the criteria for whether or not something was top secret was, is it violate, you know, national security interests? And it used to be that you had to prove that it violated national security. You don't have to prove that anymore. All you have to do is just say, I'm sorry, this is a violation of national security, and the press has to accept that, which is a fundamental change in literally our freedom to investigate, our freedom to publish. And, you know, on the one hand, we talk about that in a very nonfiction and political sense of it. On the other hand, it very much influences the fiction, the way publishing works, the way the media works, you know, across the board in this country. So it's a very, there are subtle things that do thread through, and I think on that level, we actually are living in a much scarier time, because the funny thing is, we don't even know it. So that's, you know.
I'm wondering how close you keep books by other authors at hand while you're in the process of writing, whether it's literature or art books or the Bible. In order to get yourself writing or jog your memory of something?
I don't keep books in my actual study where I work. I keep them in other parts of where I live, but not there, because I need to have a bare room. Because also you're very porous at that point, and you really don't want to get into ventriloquism. Which could easily happen. You know, it's so easy to absorb things at that level when you're making your own work. And so I just keep the stuff out at that point. But then, you know, that's a very specific time. But the rest of the time, I think, as a writer, your best friends are dead. So when you're stuck, what you have to do is go to your dead friends and get them to help you. So the thing to do is, you know, the answers are on the shelves. If you need something, you just know. I mean, I tend to get drawn to the books that I need when I'm having difficulties. And I find something in there that will prompt me forward in some way, just trusting the stuff. So it's a very energetic relationship with the dead writers, and indeed with the living writers. You know, sometimes I just think, God, I'm such shit, I'll read A.M. Holmes instead, and then that'll make me even more depressed. but actually, it cheers me up, because I think, good, no, this is okay. And it's nice knowing that people are working in the world beside you. I think the isolation of the writer is a very bad thing, knowing that there are people you admire and you respect, and they're doing their work. So when I'm not doing my work, when I'm in trouble, I can think about her doing her work. She's probably not. She's probably behind the mountain saying, my mother. I don't know that. You know, or Ali Smith or David Mitchell or any of the people. And I think, good, somewhere they're doing their work. So it's kind of okay. It's my version of God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. I think somewhere a writer's writing. So it'll be me soon.
Right, exactly. I think it's very interesting because actually I moved for the first time in, I don't know, 25 years last year, and I finally have a room to work in my apartment, which is an incredible luxury for me. But the funny thing is when they were talking about putting in bookshelves, and obviously I needed 9 million bookshelves, they wanted to put them like where I could see them in my office. I was like, oh, no, you don't understand. No books. You know, because I thought, I can have them behind me and on the side. I cannot look at books. I can look at a window. I can look at artwork. Nothing would be more upsetting to me and make me just feel like I was suffocating if I actually had to look at those books when I'm really trying to do the work. On the other hand, it's true. All the dead friends are right there. You know, and there is nothing better when you really are either tired or stuck than you go back, and it really is. It's like food. It's sustenance that you get from them, and it pushes you on. And I think that the difficulty for me is sometimes if I'm in the middle of a book, it's very hard for me to keep up with sort of contemporary fiction. I can read a lot of nonfiction and a lot of other things, but I can't read that much sort of fresh fiction while I'm right in the middle of something, because it's just it is that sense of being too porous, and it's confusing, literally, in some way.
Mm, I think that's right. Shall we go and have a drink now?
Thanks to AM and Jeanette for being here. Having the two of you here together has been amazing. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to WNYC for giving us a larger audience by broadcasting tonight's reading. And yes, there are books and there is wine, and stick around and have a great night.